Oberyn Nymeros Martell, Tyrion muttered under his breath as he fell in beside the man. The Red Viper of Dorne. And what in seven hells am I supposed to do with him?
Welcome to the White Book Podcast, the original A Game of Thrones LCG podcast.
Originally founded in 2010, as Two Champs and a Chum, we decided to rebrand when the game relaunched in the second edition. A huge thank you goes out to Fantasy Flight Games and George R. R. Martin for this game and the world we love, and of course to my co-hosts and you, the listeners. Please, if you enjoy the show, leave us a review on iTunes or your platform of choice, comment on our Facebook threads, or even better, support us on Patreon. We love turning that kind of support back into the community.
This is Season 12 of the White Book Podcast. That's generally my opinion when I look at Red Viper cards. What in seven hells am I supposed to do with this? So I figured I'd run with it.
That's fair. I mean, the only one that's really like, what are you supposed to do with this? Is the OG corset one. The rest of them have pretty like straightforward play patterns.
Okay. Well, yeah. I guess they just never quite got there.
Yeah. I mean, like. The one in this box, like, it always felt like it, like, could get there, but it's just, like, there's just not enough, like, bastards.
Yeah.
And, like, it's, like, kind of fair. And who wants fair power?
Ew, fair.
When you've got mace.
Fair in Martell? And I probably wouldn't really even call this Viper passive power, but we are getting several cards ahead of ourselves.
Oh, yes, because I don't even think we should definitely start with those cards. I think there's another card our audience desperately wants to hear.
Maybe first, let's introduce ourselves.
Does that make sense?
I'm Will, as always, on the White Book, and joined by our stalwart Roy.
Ahoy, hoy, folks.
We are moving on to the next of our retrospectives. This time, what is the formal title of this box? Sands of Dorne.
Sands of Dorne, yep.
Yeah. Some days I feel like they used up all the good names in First Ed.
I think the boxes are pretty well named in this one, like Wolves of the North, right? Isn't that...
Yeah, they're okay. I guess I just continually want to misname them and use the names from First Ed.
Yeah, that's completely fair. Like, Sands of Dorne's probably, look at these, is probably the weakest of them. But, like, the other ones are pretty good. Okay. But yeah, we're going to be talking about the Martell box. Which is exciting, continuing directly from our discussion of the Tyrell box last time, which I definitely would suggest you go back and listen to, because I think it will definitely contextualize some of the things that we're going to talk about here, because this is an interesting box. It's kind of all over the place on power level. But overall, it's very powerful.
Yeah. I think it is certainly remembered as a very powerful box.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it has one of the most busted cards they print in second edition, so.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we'll get to Fleet from Pike eventually. Like, God. Hang on. Don't get ahead of us.
Fleet from Pike. There are some very bad cards as well in this pack, yes.
The cheap shots of Thrones humor, that's what I'm here for. Mm-hmm. Well then, Where should we go to start this box out, then?
The marquee card. The card that utterly reshaped the game the moment it was printed.
Starting with the agenda, then.
Yes, like we did last time. That's a card I think people overwhelmingly remember about this box at this point. But besides maybe Dorn, that's the other really, really memorable card in the pack or in the box. I mean, it has never left the meta. There have always been Wars decks since it was printed, even when it got kind of restricted to death, where it didn't become as ubiquitous. But it remained, up to the end of the FFG era, a very playable agenda in several houses, including House Martell.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's definitely worth reading its original text. It's an omen, for what that matters. Your plot deck must contain exactly 10 cards. You may include a second copy of up to 2 different cards in your plot deck. Card designed by 2014 European Joust champion Donovan Van I believe is how you say his.
I believe so. Yeah.
If I've messed it up, I apologize. Will, why don't you go ahead and offer your opinions on the wars to come?
Well, I think particularly knowing our podcast, and honestly, probably some of the handful of folks still listening, we would be remiss if we did not take a little bit of a history trip back to the first ed agenda Defiance, which was a very similar attempt to tackle this same concept of giving you an expanded plot deck. Now, it's actually not even the first time that came about. There was even one in the CCG era, and I'm gonna be kicking myself here. I'm gonna timestamp this because I should have pulled that agenda first, because that is much harder to remember. Where is that list of bingo card guide wiki? And I need Game of Thrones blocks, Five Kings, where are those agendas? Kings of Deceit, I think. Yeah, there we go. Okay. All right, here we go. 3, 2, 1. So the CCG one, I admit, was a little different. We don't need to go hard into all of what was done at this point, but in the last base set of the CCG, we got house-specific agendas for each faction at the time, and the Lannister one let you have a larger plot deck. So that's the first attempt here that I know of. It kept you from having any neutral characters or locations in your deck, and then let you play 8 plots. So it only added 1. And actually, when you revealed your 7th, the 8th was put in your used pile right off the bat. So this was probably the most minimal attempt of that sort of thing possible.
Yeah, it's kind of like burn your 8th plot you don't necessarily need for the matchup right away, and you can't play neutral characters and locations?
Yeah.
Locations is a bit of a hit, right, because it hurts your economy base. But it is Lannister, so Lannister, I'm sure, had access to plenty of in-house.
Oh, yeah. They had a lot, and if you were following along with Alex's historical posts about the CCG era, you probably saw his post at one point about the all faction income locations that we got at one point.
That's true.
Not neutral, but all factions. And that was actually in the same set as this.
Those were also migrated their way into first edition as well.
Yes. Yeah. So Perfect. Kings of Deceit existed, didn't quite get there. Fast forward to the LCG, we hit, I just said the name a moment ago. Defiance, there we go. And Defiance played around with the prized mechanic by giving you 10 plots total and letting you reveal them as normal. You did not recycle the same way as this one did. And then gave them all prized as they moved to the use pile. Yeah, prized one. So it just slowly crept forward. And it was a neat idea. I think people were excited about the concept, but prized turned out to be too big of a trade-off, particularly with the other powerful agendas available at the time.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And, so the fact that having more plots encourages you to have a longer run game. At least in first edition, that's kind of how a lot of Defiance decks played out. And, you know, prize this bad the longer the game goes on.
Right. It was a negative that only increased as the game went. Like most agendas that have some sort of trade-off, it's generally something that you build toward being able to work around. Like as the game goes on and you draw and play more of your deck, you're able to enact whatever strategies you constructed to try to mitigate that. The easy example, Lords of the Crossing, right? As you get more characters on the board, you're able to throw bodies at the challenge and the negative strength matters less. Defiance basically only accelerated and became worse with that drawback as the game went.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I love Defiance. I played a lot of bad Defiance decks in my first year and a half of playing the game. So, but it was a really cool and fun agenda, but it was definitely a shaga or casual agenda versus one that could really compete at the highest level.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, there's also the issue of you gain in choices, but you lose some nimbleness, so to speak, when your plots do not reset at seven and suddenly your opponent has everything available to them again. And you are at that point playing with the dregs of your deck, right? I mean, sure, you're not putting in plots that you think are bad to start with, but at that point, you're definitely with the ones that you have actively chosen not to play because they were less useful.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, that kind of brings us to Wars to Come.
Yes.
And one of the reasons why that card was printed was that argument, which proved to be wrong.
Exactly. We did away completely with downsides other than that.
Yeah.
And then got the duplicate thing to kind of offset some of the 10. The only upside.
Yeah.
Very nearly.
Yeah. And the continued argument that was made in playtesting about this card, I shall not name names of any of my good friends in playtesting who made this argument, was that is a large drawback. That you're going to run to a point where your Valor gets pinned and you have five more plots, but your opponent gets access to their Valor or whatever much faster than you do. And that means it will actually really negatively impact you. And that did happen sometimes, maybe 10% of games, 25% of games, mm-hmm. if we're being like really generous.
I mean, it was rare. It was definitely rare. I mean, when you add not only in second ed the rules update, where by default you get to double up on one plot if you want, which is something the LCG and CCG plots did not have available to them, agendas did not have available to offset them. Then you add this additional one that you could double up on Wars to Come. I mean, now you just have all of the agility that you need with all of the key plots, basically. Whatever you need doubles up effectively your four star plots assuming most Thrones games are going 3 to 5 plots, give or take, like you're now looking at having your most powerful plots for essentially the entire game and not making the same sort of trade-off that would otherwise happen.
Yeah, I think like with Wars to Come, I think in many ways like the median game was about 5 plots, and the ability to run powerful but situational plots proved to be really, really, really strong. Excuse me, particularly because there's a lot, like it makes the downside of a lot of answer plots, for example, confiscation or breaking ties, to be a lot less lower. Because, you know, every plot deck, you know, there has, you know, the has, you know, of a reset that you need to play almost always, mm-hmm. right? And then, you know, you need, you know, let, you know, 2 to 3 economy-ish plots, 2 to 3 big impacting plots, right? And there's always that 8th plot, right? And, or sometimes 9th plot that you wish you could play. And Wars to Come just takes away all of that tension, right? And that's really, 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 really strong. Just in a pure mid-range game. Like, if you look at, like, the Stark Wars to Come decks or the Greyjoy Wars to Come decks that were extremely powerful at their time, the ability to run some of these situational plots that you, you know, and really be, I don't know, a little flabby in your plot deck building, but actually that flab just masks muscle, right? You know, it looks flabby. It's like, oh, they've got 10 plots, but that means you can now run Valor Doharis and Valor Margulis with no ability, that there will be plenty of games that you don't need to flip the Valor you don't need, right? Compared to a Thermal plot deck, right? So it means you can run multiple, 2 or 3 resets with the ability of maybe only having to use 2. And you can run situational plots. That's just playing the fair game with this card. Then there's the unfair ways to do it, which on one hand is using it to shore up the weaknesses of your combo deck, particularly character or location-based combo decks, less the event-based ones or the ladies ones. They didn't really ever do Wars to Come because, you know, they were going to win the game before at any of that point, and they might need a banner for something. It was really the mace decks, and in particular, and the builders decks, these high synergy decks that have specific areas of ways that you can interact with them, you know, location control, or negative attachments, and the ability to run multiple answer plots for that. So the ability to run, say, confiscation and your mace deck confiscation alongside, what's the one in this plot deck? Beyond Reproach is so huge. Or the ability to run Breaking Ties, which you may only need in like 25% of your games, but it's only going to really come up in 25% of your games because you have the ability to win by turn 4 consistently. And the same is true with Builders, which was able to bring in some additional card draw effects or some additional, like, confiscation is not a card you really want in your deck that uses negative attachments as a form of control. But when it's your 9th or 10th plot, whatever, like, there's almost, you want to be able to get that, what's the card? The bestow location answer card.
Bestow location. Oh, the event?
Yeah, no, not the event. The attachment you put on a location.
Good gravy.
Well, whatever that card is, you want to be able to get that off there, right? Or you want to be able to get the milk off your offal or what have you, right? Like, you want occasionally to be able to do it, right? And so, and there are a lot of, like, and you can also want to just run additional card draw and economy in that. So that's that, you know. That's the unfair decks that are really, really using this to shore up their weaknesses and making them, like, unbelievably consistent. This is the era, again.
Seized by the card.
Yeah. This is the era in which the Gen Con consisted of four top decks in that tournament. 3 of them played Wars to Come. Builders, Mace, and then the deck that was designed to abuse the mechanic, which was Martell Wars to Come, which remained a extremely solid deck, very playable, particularly in war formats, up to the end of the game, that abuse the idea that you have 10 plots, using plots like at Prince Doran's behest to get to kickstart it and to really start it going. And the fact that it could have all these synergies and you can get outrageous Doran's games off if you had Ricasso plus the natural amount of plots you were able to run thanks to Wars to Come is and not really have to worry about, you know, running out of that steam was just really, really powerful. And again, in probably one of the most, without a combo deck that literally is unable to interact with, the summer when the Tyrell box and the Martell box was legal was probably one of the highest power levels this game saw until the era of Targ, Sea of Blood, and Valerian Steel. And the fact that that Martell deck could compete with Builders at its prime, with Mace at its prime when it was unrestricted, really, again, shows you just how powerful Wars to Come was at every level. The fact that it was good in mid-range decks, great in linear decks, and fantastic in decks that were abusing the mechanic. It is the most powerful agenda that was printed probably up to Sea of Blood?
I think so, yeah. I don't think that's a shocking or controversial statement. I think that is just true.
I mean, Valerian Steel would be the other one. Like, those are kind of the three most powerful agendas.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have anything else you want to add about Wars to Come?
I mean, honestly, I don't know what else to add at this point, right? It became very defining, is the key card that I think nearly everyone thinks back to out of this box, and marks a fascinating kind of design turning point. Because I think this is our first agenda that had literally no downside, right? I mean, yes, there's theoretical trade-off downside, but it does not have a printed drawback.
Yeah, I guess that's true. I mean, Reigns is kind of pushing whether or not you can't run schemes in your main plot deck as a drawback.
But I mean, in practical terms, maybe not. But is it like written on there as a drawback, as a, hey, you can't do something you normally could? I would say yes.
That's fair. This is entirely additive. This is the first agenda that is entirely additive.
Yeah.
It might be the only agenda that's entirely additive.
Actually, I was thinking about that too. I think you might be right.
I mean, some of the drawbacks of, you know, Valerian Steel. Well, the drawback to Valerian Steel was much more legitimate than the drawback of Wars to Come. It is, you know, drawback. I really wish you could see the scare quotes here. It's still barely a drawback, right? Same with Sea of Blood showed that you know what, there's restrictions about when you can play events.
Right.
It's not really a restriction. It's not really restrictions. So I think it might be called specifically that this is a really bad design. I think I just want to like say that. And no offense to Donovan. Like, I didn't like this design when it was printed and in testing, and I didn't like its impact on the game. I definitely see what Donovan was trying to accomplish, and I appreciate that, but overall, it was just a bad design. And the idea of that drawback of that 20% of the time of games that, you know, it does become something of a difficulty for you. You don't always lose those games either, where you're unable to recycle your plots, but it becomes a difficulty for you. It's not worth what this card enabled.
Yeah.
But it was flashy.
Well, and sometimes that's all they want.
That's fair. Speaking of splashy, why don't we go to probably the second most famous card in the set and the one that it's responsible for a world championship win, I would say. And that's Doran. Speaking of another card, that is really poorly designed and it's extremely powerful and is one of those things where the drawback of it being 4 gold was one of the reasons why it got printed at this level. There was a belief that this card was actually weak in playtesting, and that's why the +1 reserve was tacked on. It couldn't compete with Hightower and Harrenhal. Because this was tested in an era in which Harrenhal was extremely powerful, I will be clear.
Harrenhal, the Lannister.
The Lannister one, the only one that saw consistent play. I guess actually Stark Harrenhal saw a lot more play towards the end of the game. But the only one that was really part of a super dominant deck.
Sure.
Yeah. So, you know, Dorne with its ability for every time you lose a challenge, look at the top 2 cards of your deck, add one to your hand, and place the other at the bottom of your deck, which would, this would even be a pretty, 4 gold would be too much for a location in first edition, but this would have been a busted effect in first edition because it got around the draw cast. Well, because it's not even draw a card.
Oh, yeah. Put in hand. Yep.
Anyway, what do you think about Dorne, Will?
I mean, gosh, we've talked a lot about a lot of these, four cost locations and how they continued to build off of each other. And I think part of the issue with the power creep to some extent has to do with that lag time in design coming into release, design and testing for that matter, coming into release. And you wind up, like you said, with something like this being tested at a time when Lannister in the live meta was very strong, and the 4-cost Harrenhal was very prevalent. So then you're looking at making sure that these new 4-cost locations are not, you know, below that, arguably higher to push these other factions ahead. And that was definitely the case with Hightower and Tyrell, Tyrell being kind of at the bottom of the heap before that. And I think before this box, I don't recall Martell being very consistent at all.
Yeah, that is another important context. Martell was viewed as one of the weaker houses going into this box. That's another reason why there was a willingness by the designers to push the power level of orange cards. Now, there was some debate at the time that it was mostly an illusion about how weak Martell was. Well, we won't 100% know. I think the data did argue for Martell being on at least at the bottom half of the, you know, it might have been fourth out of the eighth, right? But it was definitely one of the weaker factions. And so that's the willingness to allow some of these cards to see print the way they were. Even if this box unlocked Martell Wolf, probably one of the most NPE decks the game ever printed or ever existed in the game, and got a world championship for Leonard and largely on the back of Dorne. That deck really took advantage of that card. I don't think you mentioned this, Will, but I think that Dorne's one of the most miserable cards ever printed to play against in Game of Thrones. I would say even more than... Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I just said no, I did not say that.
it fuels your loss. Like, you feel hopeless. And this is, to use a magic term, when a Dorne resolves and you don't have an answer to it, like, you know, you're playing Greyjoy and you can, like, steal it, and you just feel kind of hopeless because it just paralyzes you. Like, every time you win a challenge, your opponent goes up a card, right? Like, with... You know, except for the entry challenge where they're card neutral, unless you have multiple claim, right? That's so frustrating to play against. And it frequently leads to the Martell player, even if you're ahead, the Martell player wants, you know, can draw into their answers to what you're doing. The other thing is this really, really does push the real, like most of Martell's themes. I think we definitely talked about this at the beginning of this series. Well, most of Martell's themes are very poor play patterns. Like, they discourage you from doing challenges into them as an opponent. They consistently punish your opponent for doing what the game is about. So it's not even like, you could say that Night's Watch also has this, you know, don't do what the game wants you to do theme. But Night's Watch doesn't have a lot of ways to punish you for winning challenges. But Martell does. So it's frequently like, okay, I don't do any challenge against Martell, so they're able to do challenges against me and do their BS. Okay. All right, well, I'll do challenges against you. Oh, wait, you have all these ways to screw me for doing challenges into you. It's frequently, like, paralyzing when playing against the Martell deck. And the most powerful cards in this set really push down on that theme. And that's one of the problems of this box, is that a lot of the Martell cards that land, Dorn, Starfall, which is a card, I actually like Starfall, but it's a card that Beguiled. These are all cards that Shadow City Bastard. These are all cards that landed and just discouraged your opponent from doing anything. And it's just some of the worst play patterns, like, in the game, come from this box.
Well, I think one big kind of not drawback, but problem here that I think even you kind of glossed over is the particular card type that Dorn is. It is historically the most difficult to deal with card type locations, the most permanent type once they're on the board. And so once that lands and you've put your opponent in that terrible self-defeating spot, as you detailed, not only is every challenge they do likely to push you closer to finding the cards you need, but like, they are that much less likely to have a solution to stop Dorn, just by virtue of it being a location.
Right. And this is something that we talked about the danger of four cost design space that we talked about when we talked about the wall, both in the first couple of episodes where we talked about the core set, but also in the Night's Watch box. The problem with four cost locations and even more expensive ungodly locations like the new wall is that the tempo loss is so high that you don't want to make them easy to interact with. But for them to be worth the four gold, their power level has to be high. So you need to push them, but you also don't want to make it so your opponents can easily answer them and trivialize a four gold location. So the tension there is just like really off and really hard to balance. Like it's like really excellent designers. And again, Nate and Danny are excellent designers for all the mistakes that they do make. They are excellent designers. Like that's hard for even the best designers. I think even with a larger group than just Nate and Danny designing cards, I think it would be extremely hard to balance four cost locations or much higher locations because that tension is really difficult to work around. And Dorn, I think, of all the locations besides Red Keep, really highlights this because of it's not even like Harrenhal gets you one character and that's kind of like an interaction. Womb of the World even gets you, you know, a character, but Dorn gets you multiple cards. Red Keep cancels your opponent's best play, right? Each round. And these two things are just so difficult to interact with. And another piece of evidence for why Dorn is so powerful is like no theme, Aaron Glazer's least favorite experience playing Thrones is when he's playing against Greyjoy and on the first turn they flip over Dorn and then steal it. That's how you know when, you know, like that's just like an instant concession, right? The same thing happens with the wall, right? Like that they're just so powerful that the ability to see it on the opposite side can just be completely belittling to your play, to your experience.
Yeah. I'm trying to think what else to add with this. Maybe just a general thought that, you know, we always have joked that draw equals win Certainly in the CCG and the first ed LCG, that maybe shifted a little in second ed, but not so far. I think that this doesn't prove to be problematic, being so repeatable that it like nullifies the downside of much of 2 out of 3 challenge types.
And makes, again, the intrigue challenge neutral.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, it's basically nullifying that, like, straight up. You're still losing some economic investment on a military challenge, probably. But you're still coming out card neutral there as well. And that's just when your opponent is attacking. Okay. That's not even throwing in the silliness that it does by getting ahead of the game when you're attacking and your opponent is just trying to defend themselves.
I'm really glad you brought that up, because I was thinking in my head, so we didn't mention the other busted thing about this, which is that, yeah, it makes a 1-strength power challenge by one of those reducers into a just like a decision paralysis. Like, do I want to give them a power here? Do I want to give them a card?
Yeah. It, honestly, it's fascinating now that I'm stopping to think about this, that, you know, you're talking about a lot of Martell's themes, particularly the whole revenge aspect, kind of stalling the game out some, kind of forcing a bit of a damned if you do, damned if you don't stasis on the game state. But I just thought, you know, if Dorne only worked on the flip side like that, that it only got a trigger after you lost on attack, how much more interesting and balanced would that be? Like, it would force this forward momentum on the game in a really interesting way. But
yeah, I wonder if that's, I feel like on the attack that might be a 3 gold location value, and on the defense it's a 4 gold. Right, I think is kind of where it is. I think they need to pick a side, right? Like, that's really one of the places where Dorne could definitely have grown as a design, is pick a side. And I think in the redesigns, they restricted it to just the military and power challenge, right? And maybe only on the defense? Or if they just put a limit 2, or even limit 3, right, would have also been all right. Yeah. Dorne is a big disaster. It's, again, one of the most powerful designs in the set, but alongside Wars to Come, a huge failure on a design level, and I think on its impact in the game was extremely negative. But the people who love to play Martell Wolf, we shouldn't entirely dismiss that. There are a lot of people who love Martell and Martell's themes. But I just think overall... And the revenge themes are extremely thematic. That's another advantage that they have. But they're just not, they're not fun for many players. Well, there was an attempt to create kind of, I guess you could say, like, a more fair theme in here. Something that's a bit more, like, challenge-based. You could say, like, positive, and I don't mean positive in, like, a positive play experience. I mean positive, like, you're doing things. You're playing to the board. You're moving the game's forward momentum. With this sort of bastard sand snake theme that exists, that has a bunch of cards to support it. It has the Red Viper that we talked about at the beginning that gives you power every time a bastard character wins a challenge, which is super cool because it also opens up space to bring in bastards from other factions. And then there's Obara, there's Tyene, Nymeria, Obella, card that I always thought it was almost there, but never saw as much play as I wanted to. Larissa Sand, and I think that's all of them. And Shadow City Bastard kind of like floats between both themes, I guess.
Oh, good old Shadow City Bastard.
It might be worth talking
about another topic.
But what do you think of the sort of sand snake theme that exists? I guess Alaria? I can never pronounce her name.
Not
Red Viper's paramour, if you like. Alaria?
Alaria. It's just not the one in this box, I guess.
Well, she's a bastard, right? Yeah. So.
Oh, yes, she is. Sorry. I thought you meant the one that plays into the bastard theme.
No, no. That one's in a cycle, right?
Yeah, yeah. I think maybe the second shadow cycle, but that's neither here nor there for this particular box. Yeah. I think I like from a sort of Ned, sort of Shaga perspective, like I love tribal decks, right? And so I'm all in on the idea of bastard, but obviously it never really comes together. And I think part of that is twofold, really, that bastards as a general rule didn't have like a cohesive theme mechanically, and that a lot of the bastard cards kind of worked sideways to the bastard theme as a whole by referring to other to sand snakes in particular. Mm-hmm. I'm looking at, say, Obara, who, I mean, I love in a vacuum, right? Like playing her along with Cor Arion for all those challenge shenanigans are great. But in the context of the bastard theme and deck, she doesn't do anything for bastards. She only interacts with sand snakes. And so it just doesn't jive. Similar things with, you know, you wind up with some stuff that plays well with general Martell themes like Shadow City Bastard with icon control. And then it sort of lines up with Alaria in that, I guess you could be neutralizing a lot of characters, but like, how many can you really hit at once in a turn? It just, they don't seem to all be lined up in quite the right way.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think the power level of them is really bad. And also the payoff isn't there, right? Like the Red Viper is an attempt to do a payoff. And I think it's a relatively successful payoff. But the redundancy isn't really there, right? And, you know, if you don't see that Red Viper, there's not a lot of, like, acceleration. There's kind of a lot of, like, moving game pieces around, but not really moving the game forward the more you interact with the Sand Snakes, yeah. Right?
Well, and honestly, thinking of Red Viper as a kind of payoff card, like some he needs bastards specifically
and all on the board, so.
right he needs bastards on the board to make challenges, but some of the most effective bastards, which hint by the way they're sand snakes, are at least out of this box and looking at this kind of package, are ones that don't stay on the board to make and win those challenges, at least not without really kind of crimping the order you can do stuff. I can make an allowance for Obara for sure, but you're also looking at stuff like Obella and the Shadow City Bastard that, like, you want those leaving the table basically as often as possible.
Yeah, no, that's definitely the case. And there's not a lot of, like, the Red Viper is a weird payoff, right? Well, he gives you the power, and he gets strength pumped up so you can intimidate and win more challenges with more bastards. But, like, there's not a lot of, like, other stealth, or you would think that, like, there'd be a...
Or any. Do they have any stealth?
Like, not in the box.
Martell as a whole?
I don't think so. Well, he's not in the... Definitely not in the box. There's not any stealth. There's not stealth. There's not another instance of intimidate. There's not, like, a lot of really tricky ways to push through challenges with the bastards to get the Red Viper going. And then, if you put a Milk of the Poppy on that Red Viper, or something else happens, so he gets dracked, because he starts at 4 strength, you know, and goes to 5 maybe easily, or maybe even 6 easily, he's very vulnerable. Like, he doesn't do much. So, like, mm-hmm. again, he's... this payoff, and he's a solid payoff. But I wish there had been, if not one more payoff, a couple more pulls. Like, Obara, as you mentioned, is kind of a pull. She's like, this is really strong. She's a sort of mini Ariane. Cool. And with core Ariane, you can get two sort of ambushes a turn. That's really cool because you can, Ariane, Obara in, and then Obara, put somebody else in. Really cool. That's cool. So that's a reason to kind of build around the Sand Snake stuff. And because I've got this pull from Obara, I have this payoff of playing the Red Viper. But everything in between, the sandwich meat or the peanut butter or whatever metaphor you want to use, is really kind of grody. Like, it's like it's a lot of things that are kind of at war with itself. And it doesn't really get that much more support as the game goes along as well. Like, occasionally you would see people play these Sand Snake decks and they're cool and fun. Like, don't get me wrong, they are very fun.
Definitely fun, yes.
Like, spinning your wheels and moving game pieces around is fun. Like, and that's what I enjoy a lot about card games. But on a competitive level, it just never lands. I mean, some of these do see play. Like, Obara saw some competitive play. And definitely, what's her name?
I mean, the Shadow Sage Bastard?
Well, Shadow Sage Bastard, that's a whole different card. Like, to me, like, that card's just so good. What's her name?
The one that dies?
No, not the one that dies. Nymeria. Like, when the 5-drop Nymeria wasn't really, like, kind of necessary over time, as sort of Martell decks moved into, like, icon control being kind of the only thing they did, like, a lot of decks were playing this Nymeria is really good. Like, she's probably the best on-rate Sand Snake. 4/4, 2 icons, and a really powerful reaction that does not require her to stay standing, to kneel, or do anything like that. And she has some cool gameplay in the sense that she encourages the Martell player to attack because you don't want to lose, you don't want to win dominance.
Yeah. Which is fascinating. That is fairly rare for Martell cards. I mean, obviously something like the Red Viper does, but
yeah. Usually the Vipers all encourage you to attack, which very thematic, smart. I want to say, like, Nymeria, because we've been mostly negative about some of the designs in this. I want to say Nymeria is a success. Like, she's a frustrating card to play against, don't get me wrong, but she has a lot of really interesting gameplay and back to forth because, you know, winning dominance frequently feels good for you, but there will definitely be times when you don't want to win dominance because you don't want to lose the one card left in your hand. And so you've got to maneuver around losing dominance to your opponent, but that also gives them a power. So and then there will be times as the Martell player, you want to win dominance because you want to be closing the game quickly, but you also need to draw a card. So there's like lots of interesting stuff, I think, going on.
And it also doesn't like stall the forward motion of the game, right? Like, the trigger here of dominance is something both you and your opponent can interact with by using your characters in challenges, by attacking and defending. And so it encourages, as you said, attacking not only on your part, but it also encourages it on your opponent's part if they're wanting to try to dodge this effect. So it's interesting compared to a lot of Martell effects in that this pushes forward motion in the game instead.
And I want to talk about a design I like, even if sadly this card didn't hit, is Darkstar. Darkstar is such a cool design, but he doesn't land. He never really saw a lot of competitive play because sacrificing a 5-cost character is a big cost.
Did he get just reamed in playtesting? That attacking and participating only stuff that just seems to yell nerf to me.
No, actually, I think he actually got improved over time.
Wow.
Because this is a very cool card, right? Like, you're attacking with a 5-strength intimidate, and it frequently is going to take your opponent 2 characters to block, and that might be good for you to be able to push challenges through. But if they're blocking with their 2 best characters, you can sacrifice and return those characters to their hand, which does have the effect of maybe bringing off their renown, burning off a dupe so you can valor. There's like lots of play. There's like, this card is such a cool design that creates decision paralysis, but creates decision paralysis equally for both players. And there's give and take, and there's a cost to both players and how they interact with Darkstar. And it's that kind of design for Martell that I think is really interesting, where it's not just creating only a headache for your opponent that's all upside for you, but you're giving yourself a headache and your opponent a headache, trying to figure out like what's the best and most optimal way to play him. And again, he's a card that encourages you to initiate challenges. And that's really cool. But he didn't land, I think, partially because the other Darkstar sort of just is better, like just generically better. And that an aggressive Martell deck never landed. Like a Martell deck that's really about doing challenges in a fair way never landed. But I think if it did land, this Darkstar would have seen play. So I love this design. I want to say nice things because I got a lot of negative things to say about other cards. I want to be like somewhat positive here. I love this Darkstar. But he did not land. I will immediately admit it.
Surely there's got to be some others that get a positive nod. I mean, there's definitely one I'm looking at. I've mentioned in passing here a couple times with the Bastard and Sand Snake stuff. I honestly think mechanically, Obella is super cool. As far as a revenge sort of mechanic goes, she kind of comes sideways at the penalty, right? Like she's not just automatically offsetting the card disadvantage like Dorn does. She kind of does something different on the two challenges she interacts with. She interacts like as revenge on the intrigue in an interesting way with the physical mechanic of pulling a card from your opponent's hand and that trepidation. I mean, I know it doesn't have to be done that way. And I definitely know people that do things like roll a die or something. But like it's one of those type of effects that I always thought was super cool in Netrunner and really amped up a lot of tension and enjoyment playing that, finding out if you're going to, you know, pull an agenda out of somebody's hand or get hit with some kind of trap. I can't remember names now, but regardless, I think as far as revenge mechanics go, Obella is like at the top of the heap for me in coolness and a unique way to tackle it that doesn't stall things out.
Yeah, Obella, she was tested a lot and nerfed a lot in playtesting. And she just didn't land. I like this card. When Glazer and I and you reviewed this, we believe that she would be a staple of Martell cards, right? Or deck.
I think so.
And it's just simply, it's because she's killed for military claim. A Valor or Wildfire, and this card is just terrible. Yeah, it's that simple. And she, for a while, didn't require that military claim. It was just when she was killed. But that was viewed as too powerful, and it may have been too powerful, because the swing that this card creates is pretty big. I like this card, but it definitely didn't land. It falls into the same category as Darkstar or some of the Emissary from the last review. Just kind of like cool cards, but ones that just didn't land on a competitive level. And I think it's like
that makes sense since you bring up Emissary, which was probably my personal favorite in that box. It makes sense we would be on opposite sides of Obella Sand.
Yeah. I mean, again, we're not on opposite sides, but we sort of draw different conclusions from having the same opinions about the card.
Okay, that's fair.
So I guess we could talk about a couple more cards that landed would be extremely negative. The second one I'll be positive and negative. Shadow City Bastard. Terrible design. Because
Fleabottom?
Of Fleabottom, yeah. Like, it kind of falls off once Fleabottom is gone. But I think its reign of terror alongside Fleabottom will long be remembered. I do think that the printed cost 5 or lower, it should have been 4, I think, would have been better. There's just so many cards that this deck, this thing shuts down, and it encourages you to play big guys. And I think that kind of the tension is weird in this card. as well, that it kind of like makes your opponent's smaller characters less useful. I don't know if that like fits the theming of when you say like Shadow City Bastard. Wouldn't it be some drawback for like a powerful lord or lady versus you know, hitting the lower end people? I'm not quite like, I'm not 100% sure. Like,
I viewed it as the Shadow City Bastard only had access to the other like low born or low blooded or, you know, whatever, the cheaper tier characters, like that was all they could get to disrupt. They couldn't, because they were a bastard, they couldn't get up to the upper realms.
That's fair. There's great art on this card.
Oh, definitely.
And for a card that was played so much, it's good that it had good art. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I definitely do think that this was largely a failed design because it was so abused with Flea Bottom. And then once Flea Bottom's gone, it becomes such a marginal card. There's no happy medium for this card. It's either all in, busted, so frustrating to play against, or not worth it because Flea Bottom has been restricted alongside every other good card in the game.
Yeah. Out of curiosity, did you ever see it ambushed? I'm not sure I honestly ever did.
I think I did.
It feels neat in theory, right? I like the idea, but in game states when I was playing it, I just never felt like I wanted to blow the extra gold for it versus having it on the board as a threat of activation instead.
I think because of its timing restriction, I did see it ambushed a few times, particularly in the era in which Martell decks were drowning in gold thanks to trade routes. So, you know, if you've got 17 gold and you say pass, you know, in that situation, you can, you know, if you know, particularly if your opponent knows you have, say, one in play for Flea Bottom, right? Mm-hmm. You want them to think they're safe after that you get the first one, right? I think I saw that a few times, but I don't think it was really like worth it because there weren't very many ambush payoffs in Martell the way in which there were ambush payoffs in Tyrell, which seems a little weird, right? You think Martell would all be about ambush and Tyrell wouldn't be, but that's not.
Go figure.
Where the color pie design space fell. So another card that I have such mixed feelings about is Starfall. Before I go off on this card, Will, what's your take on this card?
See, I thought you were pretty positive on Starfall from a passing comment that you made earlier. Honestly, overall, I'm positive on this. It's strong, requires decent planning for a control effect. I don't know. In a lot of ways, I feel like this is a pretty good spot for a control effect in second ed. Even though, in general, control never really lined up the way some first ed veterans wanted. This, I think, probably gets the closest to that in the framework of second ed, and I'm pretty okay with where it wound up.
Yeah. So I think Starfall is where the ceiling of Martell control effect should be.
Okay.
I think this card is as fair as you can make this kind of effect, right? It's three gold, so it's expensive, protected from some of the like lower end work, like what's the Greyjoy card that requires your opponent to be first player to kneel things? Lord Port Shipwright, right? Some of the location control is done, but it's still at three cost. Your opponent can interact with it, but you know, you pay the three gold, and while you don't necessarily get the tempo back of paying that three gold, you do get its effect right away, right? That's good. The problem is when you combine Starfall, Dorne, Shadow City Bastard, Beguiled, and the icon attachments, that's when Dorne starts getting like really obnoxious. Or not Dorne, excuse me, Starfall gets really obnoxious. So like, I like when Dorne was restricted away and sort of Martell control was very much about answering mid-range decks, I really liked where Starfall was. And some of those like HRD Starfall decks that existed for a while, when the game became like all about Greyjoy doing Greyjoy things, and you know, Starfall really could stop them, and Greyjoy does have a lot of really good ways to interact with attachments besides We Do Not Sew, and you know, if you put a bunch of control attachments on their characters, they can't win unopposed challenges. It was really good. I think that that's where it should land, but in combination with all the other Martell control elements, and here's where I disagree with you, Will, and it's like I argue with Glazer all the time. Second edition, control was good. One, the best control deck in the game was Builders, which Glazer would never admit, but is true. Two, Martell Wolf won a world championship and was very playable for a long time.
Was Builders control or just really slow combo?
It was control with a combo finisher. Like, it played all these negative attachments and stopped your opponent from doing what they wanted to do until you could. Like, it's one of those things, like how am I put this? And this is going to be one of them. I don't think I've ever said this on the podcast, but like, control players like to feel like they're Aristotle. They think that they're smarter and better than everybody, or really they're Plato. Let's be honest with you. That's mean to Aristotle. They think they're Plato. They're Plato. One, they like to, you know, put words in their opponent's mouths. Two, they think they're smarter than everybody, all right? And they want to show off their opportunities about smarter that they are than you, all right? And, it takes huge, big galaxy brain to play a bunch of orange cards to take your opponent's icons away so they can't do anything, all right? Anyway, that's my salt right there about listening to Glazer go on about control for many years, and he's not here to defend himself.
Exactly.
So I'm really being very platonic right now.
And I don't have the that Glazer seasoning to try and defend his side of that particular discussion.
Yeah, I mean, Martell Wolf was very playable until it got like really restricted. Like, think about the number of Martell Wolf cards that were on the restricted list at the end of the game, right? Like, you couldn't really play Leonard's deck. And then when the Martell Wolf deck kind of came back after that a little bit, it got hit sort of incidentally by other restrictions, but because some of the start cards in that deck were too powerful, and some of the plots were sort of generically too powerful, and that brought it down. But, like, Martell Wolf was good. And that's and was a really good and powerful control deck. Again, it won a world championship.
Yeah, no. I mean, yes, I would say in the end that it probably was a control deck. I feel like we did have some discussions on the show at the time about whether it leaned into like a tempo realm, but like, I don't know. In a lot of ways, you could just say that is Thrones in general. That's probably not a road we need to go down.
Yeah, I mean, we did do an episode where probably the angriest on the show Aaron and I have ever been with each other was when we talked about archetypes on the show and we laid out what archetypes are in Thrones, that I got so angry with him that I did a video without him. Which I think that one is on the Beyond the White Book YouTube channel, I think. I'm not sure if it was before or after I migrated onto the White Book YouTube channel for some of those videos. But it's definitely, if you want, you know, sort of my overview on the archetypes and Thrones, you can definitely watch that. I think it's aged pretty well. Do you have anything more do you want to say about Martell cards, my friend?
Are there any I want to hit on? As just a general scheme, and honestly, this kind of piggybacks off of some of the Obella thought, like, I do appreciate kind of sideways cards that didn't quite land, that were at least trying to bring a new angle to the table. I mean, yeah, Hotaz Axe saw some play, but it wasn't, you know, in the same class as some of this other stuff we're talking about, like Dorne and the Bastard and so on. But it is at least a cool kind of eye-catching, you know, gears start turning sort of mechanic. Honestly, similar with something like Patience. That one, I think, did not come into the play that even Hota's axe did. But I do like that there are some attempts in this box at on theme but new mechanical takes for Martell.
That's fair. That's fair. I mean, Hota's axe did see some play and is a super obnoxious card when it gets going.
Yeah, no. I'm not saying it didn't, but it's not captured the level of play and power and kind of popular consciousness of something like Adorn.
Definitely. I mean, it's an annoying card more so, but it's just not as annoying as some of the other cards.
Sure.
And again, it does kind of want you to be a little bit more like interactive than like challenges interactive.
Right.
Than like Martell decks kind of really became. So anything else before we move to
I'm good for the off houses.
The off houses ready to do that?
Yeah.
What stands
out? We can finally hit Fleet from Pike. I know, I've been waiting. this is just a joke, listeners. I have no need to talk about Fleet from Pike other than it's just bad.
I mean, we do get a pretty good Lannister card here. Marcella is a pretty good Lannister card. I mean, we get one of the worst Lannister cards, but we do get, like, this is the first good Lannister card. Like, yeah, like,
good. I mean, and she's card. Just, like, reasonable efficient. She's not, like, good. She's just like I would definitely play one copy of her and not be sad about it.
Yeah, but we haven't even gotten that for a while, Will.
Well, that's fair.
So there we go. So there's kind of a pattern going forward with Lannister where they get like one medium card and then one awful card for a while. Where there's a lot of like packs that are like that. It's like, okay, this is like a one of in some Lannister decks, and then this card is hot, steaming garbage. For a while, it was two busted Lannister cards, then two utterly garbage Lannister cards, and now it's one okay Lannister card and one garbage card. So, you know, things are starting to improve.
We're looking up. But then we get Night's Watch, which I'm sure is what you are just dying to talk about.
Not so much. Like, I don't super love Spare Booty. I appreciate him, and I have enjoyed some decks in which you can abuse him, and I will forever love the interaction with him and, well, Turncoke is one of them. But that's a stupid interaction. Him and the there's another stupid interaction I don't like, Seal of the Hand, where you can stand Seal of the Hand but it doesn't move. That's a really stupid interaction should not exist. It's with Catapult, where you can, catapult doubly in a turn. That's a fun interaction. We had a Martell Stag deck that was built around about using that for a while. And that was cool. But he is very powerful, and he is one of the staples of kind of the Jontron and Valerian Steel decks. The Valerian Steel decks, he's kind of like, I think he's a two of these days, but like, you know, he's like a one of two of. You like seeing Spare Boot, it's nice, but you don't really need to see him compared to sort of like Jontron at its peak that really wanted Spare Boot to abuse Jon and stand him multiple times and do all kinds of shenanigans. But he's a very powerful card. His design's pretty good. Like, I think a lot of the problems with Spare Boot are less problems with Spare Boot and more problems with Thrones rules.
Yeah, the weird interactions.
Yeah. Because like what this card is trying to make you do is like use two cool attachment twice a turn at the cost of it going on to a crappy character, which I think is a cool design. A very interactable character as well. And then, you know, in the fact you can get negative attachments off your characters as well. But, you know, with the weird rules interactions, he kind of, you know, just didn't quite get there. Like as a good design that I would want to like say is one of the better designs in the box. But I mean, let's talk about Great John real quick. Do you have any Great John feelings? Cause then we get like four bangers in a row after Great John.
Okay, yeah. Greyjoy. I mean, just a stalwart staple of virtually all Stark from here on out, right? Just very, very efficient. Definitely great in the early game for a Lord of the Crossing deck. But even solid, I definitely saw some Sea of Blood later on floating around. I mean, there's just very little downside. Sort of like I said for Lannister with Myrcella, like, oh yeah, I will always happily play one copy of her. I feel that way about Greyjoy. There are decks where I may want more copies of him for a specific purpose, but I will never feel bad about just a very efficient 5-for-5 intimidate,
5-for-5
multiple intimidate. Challenge. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he's just one of the best Stark characters. I mean, he did fall out occasionally of some of the like really low to the ground Stark fast builds, but definitely in this era, he was one of the most powerful Stark cards. And many, you know, I lost many a game to a Stark Cross and had him on setup, right? And, you know, that 2-challenge intimidate is in the early game is extremely, extremely powerful. And as much as it pains me because I'm not super fond of the very fast Stark rush decks, I think he's a very solid design. Pretty thematic to that Stark, you know, do, you know, powerful effects early in the game ability. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that was a neat tack to take for Stark, and I think lines up very well with this particular character as well.
Mm-hmm. That's fair. So the next four, the Targaryen Lannister, or Targaryen Tyrell cards are all extremely strong. Missandei, ubiquitous, multiples in every Targaryen deck, probably one of the most annoying cards in the world, particularly combined with Quotha, who I think was in the previous box, right?
Yes, sir. Yep.
And couldn't remember if he was in Watchers or in this. No, Watchers has the stand location. Oh my god. Yeah, that's just so many bangers. For Targaryen here, yeah, she's one of the worst designs in the set. Like, I mean, she's cool, but she's just, her power level is so, so, so high. And like, and we missed understanding this card's power level in testing. You know, seemingly a 2-for-2 with nothing going for it, except for the fact that if it's discarded from your hand or deck, it can come into play. Seems innocent enough, but the fact that so many Targaryen effects are powered off the discard, and the fact that she turns that, of course, into you can sometimes be card plus thanks to her.
Yeah, so many. She's really the first of what then became a theme of that card discard not really being a drawback, right?
I don't think that there's many other. The fact that you could safely play 3 of her is what kind of made that. There's no other cards that I think really took away that being a drawback besides her. But she just made, because you're running 3 of her, and the fact that she could make her dupes come into play, so even if you had to set her up, that no, until she dies, there's no downside to drawing additional Missandeis in many Targaryen decks, right? And then frequently, when she's dead, you have enough discard effects that you're okay with chucking her dupes. So really, the opportunity cost of just playing her is really high, again, when Meereen is really powerful, Quotho is really powerful, the stand location is really powerful. What's the other one that's in the Targaryen box? Incinerate is really powerful. Am I missing one? Discard to do stuff. Of course, I'm missing the most annoying one, Queensguard. Like, all of these, like, the fact that she just fuels all of these is so freaking obnoxious. Then Quarth, I'm sorry, I'm just going off, Will. Quarth should not have been given to Targaryen, because one of the good answers to powerful Targaryen cards, like either Dany, Drogo, what's his face? The 7-drop that frequently you bring into play with Aegon. whatever his name is, Dario. There we go. These powerful, powerful characters is to play negative attachments like Milk of the Poppy. And to just give them this point and a click attachment removal. It also, if you have that frozen solid or that seized by the guard for the Marine, nope, Quarth just shuts down all attachment-based interactions. I hate this card so much. I hate both of these cards so much. And they're both terrible designs. And definitely, I understand that I don't like that attachment. I like the Targ theme of attachments being a positive theme for them, but they should not have been one of the factions that was given attachment control.
Yeah, Targ. I guess, you know, this is another example of the fine FFG history, something they've been doing since the CCG era, of giving like both faces of a coin to the same faction, doing things like giving positive attachment effects and negative, you know, attachment hate, attachment love and attachment hate to the same faction, or location love and location hate to the same faction, things like that. And I've never really understood that from a long-term design standpoint. To some extent, I sort of understood it in the CCG era when you added these factions. In particular, Targaryen has had that problem with attachments since it was added to the CCG. But it was not in the initial three houses of the game, right? It was the fifth faction added later. And to some extent, I got the vibe that FFG was stretching for the themes that they wanted to use for this new house, because it was not the color pie was not planned out to include it initially. And so I can see how you come to that point where you put both faces of that same coin in the same place when you didn't plan it out initially. But like the LCG could. First Ed could have reworked that. The Second Ed definitely should have reworked that type of thing. And I don't really feel we got that.
No, we did not. Quarth should not have been a Targ card. I agree with you. Like, I much rather would have seen it go into Baratheon or Stark. Stark got a little bit of attachment hate. Weirdly, Frozen Solid did not go on attachments, right, in second edition?
Yeah, I think it was just locations in second ed.
Yep.
But we can find out.
But definitely, you know, giving that to another faction. You know, and Greyjoy also got some attachment hate. So it being, you know, secondary, attachment hate being secondary in a couple of factions, even Lannister, I don't necessarily think out of the core set giving Lannister easy access to Milk of the Poppy effects, but as Lannister's power level declined, giving it additional parts of the color pie made sense. The same in which Baera started getting some location hate towards the end of the game, as, you know, Baera's sort of, it was clear to the designers that, like, Baera's space was really narrow, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, and also it got some event cancel and stuff. So, you know, I think that that's the direction they should have gone versus, again, the fact that some of the best answers to Targaryen were attachments, and then they were given easy, efficient attachment answers in the form of Quarth. Despise this card.
Yeah. Oh, I don't know that I have more to add on the Targ front.
Why don't you go ahead about the green cards then?
To the green cards. I mean, I think these are interesting ones. Leighton, I definitely recall folks tinkering with, and obviously he fits into Mace style stuff pretty well. But I feel like it always kind of came out kind of limited to that type of scope. I don't remember seeing him in things beyond that. Beacon had some power grab homes. I think it definitely was in some Tyrell Lords of the Crossing.
Oh, definitely.
Didn't it wind up in one of the combo decks in the Brienne one?
I think it was definitely in the Brienne one. And I think it was also in some of the versions of the Renly one.
Okay.
I almost certainly was in the Renly one when I played against Sandy playing it. I'm pretty sure he had at least one Beacon of the South. There were a bunch of Voltron Beacon of the South decks that were based on either Renly or Brienne. And the fact, you know, that this could also be used on your like backup combo character, Randall, mm-hmm. Was also really powerful. And this definitely saw some fairer play as like a one of in the crossing decks. So, you know, as one gold, it's pretty efficient. And I think they did a good job.
Goes on any Tyrell character. Which
any type.
So many of these types of attachments, we would see like a, you know, Lord or Lady restriction or something.
Yep. Yeah. And I don't think Leighton is a very good design. He's kind of narrow, and like putting him into play Nelt is cool. And like your ability to like use him and put, like the strength pump Hightower Spy into play, pump someone's strength, have some like surprise military claim stuff was cute, but like at the end of the day, he was mostly just about getting weird mace triggers, like mace in standing, you know, or he's the dominance trigger for mace, and then you use mace's ability to go into the standing phase, and then he stands up, and so you've got like 7 power in one turn with him. Yeah, I don't think he's a very good design, though. I think there's nothing interesting about this Leighton. Like, you're just going to abuse him, or you're not going to play him. Because a 5-for-3, 2 icons. I mean, I guess he also saw some play in the Marge decks, because he was a lord.
Oh.
And you could kill him and turn him into...
Man, I never played him in my Marge decks. Like, mine were all the top tier ones, but they had a lot of other lords to choose from.
He was you didn't have a huge number of lords you wanted to kill. I think I remember John was big on putting one of him in, because, you know, you could do something like kneel him, put in Hightower, and then kill him in the military phase and get Randall.
Yeah.
Or Renly. So the fact you could get some value out of him, and then he became sort of useless and that kind of stuff was pretty good. But yeah, but these were both very solid, and you know, he was a staple in the mace deck. So I think it's worth talking, I guess, about, let me double check here.
Neutrals, I mean, I see one answer card that did, well, not answer, but kind of control-y card that did see some play. An answer card that people were excited to see that didn't pan out. And kind of an extra linchpin for a tribal deck that was pretty strong.
Yeah,
I mean, that was the highlights to me.
She's busted. You just needed, like, a reason to play Wildlings. And she definitely was very, very strong. Very, very, very strong. I mean, she's a little expensive, but she was really a really strong payoff for being in Wildlings.
Very strong. But she does at least, I think, tie in nicely to that aggressive theme and like keeps the deck moving forward. I mean, it's all aggression there all the time, but I think if you're going to do card advantage, I like this type that leans into that pressure, and in a way that potentially opens you up to, you know, some board control resets, that type of thing, rather than just loading up your hand. So,
yeah. It's true. And, you know, the combo of her and her sister is really expensive. So, you know, that's 11 gold, I believe. I think Dahlia is.
She's a 5. Yeah.
So, you know, it's pretty expensive. And it was specifically designed at the, let me just tell you in playtesting, that she couldn't put 5 in the play because of her. And obviously you don't want her putting, originally she just put a Wildling character, and, you know, you could put Mance and you could put, what's his face? Rattleshirt into play. No bueno. But
it, what about then, Mag? Does Mag also have the wild entry? Yeah.
I don't think Mag is printed yet. I think he's in the next. Maybe he's a no. He's been printed, I guess. So it was also Mag. You didn't want to put Mag in either. So that's why the four was also to keep you away from, you know, getting that dump that card in. So she's a tempo card, right? She's not necessarily card advantage.
That's a better analysis, yeah.
But with Dala, she's both. You know, and if you have her and Dala in play, then you're, you know, just doing it. But, yeah. Poorly designed card, off to Gulltown, which is designed kind of as an answer card to Martell, but just became a ubiquitous... stupid card. Like, this card is just stupid. Like, it's one of the stupidest neutral cards that they printed. It's just so ubiquitous.
It cycles for one and gives you a pretty reasonable upside. So it deck thins. There were potentially some song triggers depending on what it was.
Oh yeah, there were song decks that definitely this was extremely important in. It smoothed out crossing. It took away one of the drawbacks of a lot of crossing decks. This card is real stupid.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was playable. I mean, it was not believed that it would be playable without the draw card. That's why it was staked on. And of course, that theory proved to be wrong.
Turned out to be too much.
Yeah, and this is one of those.
Pay one, draw a card by itself is really good. Like that, by itself, I think there might be Thrones decks that want to play that.
I don't know. Like, the difference between Thrones and Magic is like a card like that, it doesn't do anything for the board at all, ever. And just like a card that's blank and cycles for one, like unfair decks would definitely want it. But I don't know if like fair, like the thing about off to go.
I didn't specify fair. I just said that there were decks.
Yeah, I mean, there were like the combo decks and stuff like that. But I think, you know, I don't think anybody, even that's not true, the true combo degens would love that card. But I think that this is as close as Thrones has ever gotten to that, and it proved to just be so, so ubiquitous. So just, this card didn't fulfill its design intent and ended up being just overpushed. And this is a card that I definitely wish had been in a cycle, so if rotation ever existed, they could later print a version of this that does the same effect just with no card draw.
This I think is a fascinating example that even cards that at first glance appear very vanilla, very boring, very straightforward, can still wind up being problematic in application.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, these two boxes have a lot of those kind of cards. And the boxes in general do. I think it's worth... I don't know if it's worth spending a lot of time talking about Jade Seed Drummond. You mentioned it kind of briefly.
Yeah. I don't know if it's worth going hard on, but I think this does harken back to our earlier discussion about locations, them being the safest card type and in some ways the hardest to balance because of it. And Jade Seed Drummond obviously was an attempt to bring some of that control and impermanence to locations, but it is hamstrung itself largely, I think, by virtue of the limited keyword and the economic setup of Thrones and
two gold.
The trade-off of investing two gold and sacrificing your limited slot for the turn, and then for a very delayed removal effect, it did not line up well.
Right, and the fact that it didn't pay itself the turn you played it. I mean, you could remove a location the turn you played it, but then you're paying two gold to remove the location dominance, which means frequently your opponent got, to trigger it in challenges because most of the best locations triggered in challenges, mm-hmm. or triggered as a reaction to winning dominance, and this doesn't do jack against that.
And you've forgone playing actual econ at that point.
So basically the ideal situation is this be one of your setup limited locations. And then times when you don't like it, and it's such a bad econ card against opponents that aren't playing location decks, you know, like if it's just a fair mid-range deck that maybe has like one non-limited location that it cares about and it barely cares about it, it just, and it of course doesn't line up with some of the most powerful locations like Flea Bottom. It lines up really poorly against
It either the trade just was really not worth it mathematically for a low cost one like Flea Bottom and timing wise, or it just couldn't hit something like a Heron Hall or a Dorn or a High Tower. Right.
And you really don't want a neutral, easy point and click answer to those kind of locations. Jason Strowman is the first of several attempts to print neutral location hate. The first one is
put to the torch and the core set.
Right. Like since the core set, the first one's
Seized by the Guard. We did talk about was before this,
and so
and that was a pretty reasonable option. That's a lot of play.
Yeah, that one's really good. Of a card removal. I'm thinking of the one that blows up contested locations.
Is that one Lay Waste or Lay?
No, Lay Siege. And then Lay Waste is the other one.
Okay.
But again, like all location hate, Aaron and I thought that this would be much better than it was. And it was very strong in playtesting. In fact, this was a card that was a lot of work was put into this card. Alongside Wars to Come, alongside another card that was one of the most controversial cards that we've ever tested, Breaking Ties. Well, Louise, you know, LGB, friend of the show, right? Did you ever have Louise on an episode?
I think so, actually. I think after his Melee win, I'm pretty sure we did.
Yeah. I think it was back when it was still 2C1C. You may have had him on. You know, this is one of the most powerful. I mean, there are two unbelievably powerful champ cards in this box. And this was a card that warped the meta almost as much as Wars to Come did. It like really, really made some cards really unplayable, or if not unplayable, just so inconsistent that you didn't want to run more than one of them. Like this is a card that, for example, pushed Randall Tarley very much out of the meta. Trying to play a Tyrell deck that wanted to stack power on him, or even a fast Tyrell deck that wanted to stack power on him, was kind of laughable. It significantly brought down the wall, also lost a lot of its cadence.
I mean,
Breaking Ties.
That I think a lot of us were thankful for, though.
Yes, yes. I'm trying to think of other really annoying. There's just a lot of non-loyal cards that were pushed out of the meta, or at the very least, their meta share was strongly reduced by this card. And then, of course, let's not forget like what it enabled, and it just enabled some insane tempo plays that just very few cards were as capable of tempo swings as Breaking Ties.
Yeah, this led to some big ones. And again, it is another example of one that was particularly problematic when combined with Flea Bottom.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And the limit twice per round. And it's just
action. Yeah. So you could just sacrifice whatever loyal Chud, I don't know, Toman for a random example, and then immediately pop him back in and bounce something again.
Yeah. Birds the birds were really good with this in Night's Watch.
Night's Watch. Yeah.
Yeah. The other thing is this card also was just so flexible. Like it could be almost everything you wanted it to be. And the fact that, you know, it was Plot Equivalent. For a while it wasn't.
Yeah.
Like this is also one of those cards that I have trouble remembering exactly how it works because it went through so many iterations of playtesting. And sometimes I will remember what it was in playtesting, which has cost me games before. or cost me games because I thought the card was stronger than it ended up being, or forgetting that, oh yeah, they buffed this, it does additional things. But the fact is, it could be a choke card sometimes. It could be a tempo play. It could bounce your own stuff to get around what your opponent is trying to do, or set you up for a reset, right? Like, I saw Breaking Time, it's like, sack my non-duped, loyal, good character, bounce my non-loyal character back to my hand, Valor, play another copy of that loyal character, and, you know, flea bottom in the non-loyal character. Like, it's, or the other way around. It's just such a ridiculous card. It's a cool card, but it's a ridiculous card that probably should have been printed as it was. It was too good.
Yeah, yeah. Agreed. I mean, and I suppose on the plot front and too good, the other culprit we're staring at is probably Forced March, right? Both of which I think fascinate me because on top of a very strong repeatable effect, they also had some pretty like wild stats in regard to initiative in particular, which is kind of subtly lets you abuse their effects even more, which I find very interesting about them. Forced March, I think, is also interesting to me, as this is the first one of these cards that I would straight up say was even more of a busted ass problem in Melee than it was in Joust. If I had a dollar for every game where I saw this thing effectively kneel every player's board, just completely. Ugh.
Yeah, and the fact that it's strong in so many decks, it's the thing that I hate about Forced March is how good it is in crossing decks, right? Because it feels like a control card to me. Like, that's what its design was, you know, I kneel one of your characters, and then I kneel a bunch of your characters, so that kind of, like, puts us relatively even. And the ability of crossing decks to seize the initiative, to go first, trigger the Forced March, kneel your best defenders, and get that military challenge for free, if you didn't have another good military challenge, like a red icon card in your hand, was so frustrating. The fact that they could do it twice in a row was so annoying. Oh my God, I'm having the memories. was so annoying. It's just, this was an extremely frustrating card. And again, a very poor design. As much as it's a cool design, and it's like, it seemingly has some kind of cost, but of course, you quickly learned very fast that that cost was not as high as you would think. And it's frequently so much better for you, because again, of course, you're choosing when to flip Forced March, the cost ends up being very easily mitigated.
Absolutely.
All right. I think that brings us to the end here, Will, of this.
Yeah, I think so.
This box. Overall, what would you say about this box?
So the box in general, I think this is a very, very strong option. And I think it still shows that clear box power creep. This is probably very close to the Tyrell box overall. But in my memory, at least, it stands out more. It looms a little larger, I think, because of Wars to Come, which... not only the rest of the box really pushing Martell and giving us gems like Dorne, but this really became ubiquitous for virtually every house. And I don't think the Tyrell box really did that the same way.
I think the Tyrell box warped the entire meta around itself. And it did so in like really obviously green cardy ways, where you went from these green card combo decks to these green card mid-range combo decks for like from it when it was released in the winter of 2017 up to the summer of 2018. So like that 9 month period really became just all about green cards from that combo winter up to the Reign of Mace. I think that the impact of the Martell box is a little bit more subtle because the Tyrell box is so much louder. At least it was to me. Cause again, Mace decks were just so good for so long. And were better than a lot of the decks that were based on Martell box cards. Although, fellow White Book member, Rob Mixer, did win that Gen Con with Martell Wars. But he had to do some really close matchups against Tyrell players to get there. And that's just a really good... No, that's not, it wasn't Rob that won. It was Tyler, sorry. Tyler won. I apologize. Tyler had to push through like a lot of and play extremely well through like the Tyrell deck was not a great matchup for him. And he outplayed myself included to get there. And so again, the cost of the loudness of the Tyrell box, I think this box got a little overshadowed, but I think overall it had a bigger impact because a lot of these cards didn't get restricted for a long time, including Force March, which felt like it would never go away. I think that the problem is Tyrell box also has trade roots. So I think they're about the same power level, but I think they're more inconsistent. I think the Tyrell box has overall a steadier power level than the Martell box, which has like big spikes and then real low lows, in which I think overall the Tyrell box is kind of like just a little bit more powerful overall than the orange card box.
On a card for card consistency basis, you know, I might get around to that. But I still think just the broader feel of this one, like you said, Tyrell warped that direction, right? Like skewed around Tyrell, which made it feel very Tyrell centric. The Martell box, as good as some of the Martell cards are, I just think that the Wars to Come warping every other house in ways that didn't point specifically at that box's house gives it a bigger impact for me.
That's completely fair. But I do think that these are two of the more powerful products, and they do mark an age. And for me, again, I think from Flight of Crow, from Watchers on the Wall, really, to Dance with Shadows was the most fun that I've had playing the game. The sort of like middle of 2017 to middle to sort of end of 2018, I guess Worlds 2018. Was really the peak of the game for me. And I'm excited that we get one more product to talk about before I'll be completely honest.
Before the downward slide.
Many of the products, particularly the remaining three boxes, I will have almost nothing but negative things to say about them as designs and experiences. So it's nice to sort of talk. I do think I was pretty harsh on some of these Martell cards, but I did appreciate this era of the game overall, and it was the happiest I ever was playing the game.
Yeah, this was a great period. Absolutely great.
All right, well, I know you've got a couple of things you want to talk about before we run off into the danger zone.
A couple? Oh gosh. I only had one that I remembered offhand. So you may have to correct me on the other, but the first one is that I am running my first ever Kickstarter kicking off February 11th for an RPG for their Zine Quest event. So each one of them is only 2 weeks long. If you're considering coming back to that late in the game, they're only running 2 weeks. My game is Warmer in the Winter. It is kind of a holiday Hallmark romance movie styled RPG. but you could bend it in some other directions, I am sure. I'm looking at you, Gilmore Girls. So if you want to know more about it, there is a page to follow right now. You can find that at bit.ly/warmerRPG. Do make sure you capitalize RPG because it's case sensitive. And that will that is up, so you can follow it now, and more info will be coming soon.
Well, let's be honest here, Will. Gilmore Girls and its spiritual successor, Virgin River, are basically just Hallmark movies with better acting and production values. Like, their tropes are very, very much the same. Their tropes are very, very much the same. That's more of, I guess, a props and slops topic. But also don't, I guess, congratulations is in order that you are one of the members of the board of directors of the, what is the name it finally ended up with?
The Global Operations Team. Yeah.
So congratulations, Will. And I think for listeners, this should be really exciting. It's a attempt started by friend of the show, Egg, to, you know, heal some of the wounds of 2020. And 2019, we'll be completely honest, sort of the last year and a half of the game, and sort of maybe build a future.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's a great team that we've got put together right now. And I think the title of the team, or the role, I suppose, that folks may have already seen in Egg's announcement, and subsequent update, is the Board of Trustees. So I think it is nice to have that stated as the focus off the bat, and have a core group of folks dedicated to that role and building out further from there. I don't want to say too much because I'm gonna have Egg on in a couple weeks here, and we can get more detailed about where things are gonna go. But I think the team is a solid one.
Absolutely, I have nothing but faith in that group of people's ability to act as caretakers of this game that has meant so much for so many of us.
Thank you. See, we're not even gonna end on a danger zone then, I guess.
Well, Will. The pandemic is still raging, so we're always in the danger zone.
Too true. We'll be right back.